Monday. Tuesday. Wednesday. Thursday. Friday. Saturday.
It's time for Shank Talk Worldwide with your host, Peter Shank.
Wonderful Radio London. Whoopee.
Greetings. My guest today is Mark Weber from the Institute of Historical Review. Thanks for joining me, Mark, on this auspicious occasion, the inauguration of the first black president of the United States.
I'm pleased, Peter, to be on your show to talk about the new president, Barack Obama, which begins today.
I'd like to start off the interview with a quote from Frederick Douglass, who could be considered the Barack Obama of his day, although he never made it to the highest office of the land. And the quote goes as follows. The Jew was once despised and hated in Europe, and is so still in some parts of that continent. But he has risen and is rising to higher consideration, and no man is now degraded by association with him anywhere. In like manner, the Negro will rise in social scale. End quote. Just as Frederick Douglass predicted, blacks would rise on the racial scale. Booker T. Washington further implied that unless blacks have unity, pride, love of race, and become more influential in this country, like Jews, they could not expect to obtain any degree of success in America. Washington's message implied that black failure to imitate Jews would ensure failure in America.
Well, certainly it's appropriate because today is a very historic day with the inauguration of the first African-American president in our history. One of the points I think it's worth stressing is that the presidency and the president is not merely a chief executive or a chief administrator. He's also a symbol of America, a personification of America. And Barack Obama is not merely going to be a person who's expected to handle problems and make decisions. He also speaks for America, and he symbolizes something that's been happening in America over the last 30, 40, 50 years. And that is the transformation of America from what was or has been essentially a white European Christian country to a third world country. And this change has been going on for quite a while, and Barack Obama's presidency personifies and symbolizes that change, which in a very dramatic way.
I would say that Barack Obama's election as president of the United States is the completion of the urbanization or Africanization of our culture.
Well, I wouldn't say it's a completion of a process. It's symbolic of a process that's still going on. But today's speech and the Barack Obama campaign has been noteworthy for a couple of things. This is a very, very strange time in American. Recent public opinion polls show that the American people are very unhappy on the direction the country has been going in. And these polls have been taken for many years and have been showing a steady drop, not just during the Bush administration, but for many years, of confidence in our political system, in our economic system, and so forth. And at the same time that there's been this steady decline in confidence in our system, In a grave, wide sense that something is very wrong with the direction the country is going in, Barack Obama has been elected with a huge pledge and a strong message of promise of change, that he's going to reverse that. Now, what's amazing to me is the kind of duality or schizophrenia in the campaign. At the same time that expectations about the presidency are very high, Barack Obama has also been warning that these pledges that he's been making and made very forcefully once again today in the inaugural speech are not going to be easy and that the American people have to sacrifice. And therein lies the problem. People want change, but they really don't want much sacrifice. There has been sacrifice, and there's going to be a lot more sacrifice. And although Barack Obama is talking about that, the expectations of especially his supporters and the American people in general are that the huge problems that we see are going to be able to be overcome without any great sacrifice, without any great turmoil. So that Barack Obama today is simultaneously trying to pledge that America is going to return to its greatness, return to its prosperity, live up to its so-called message of freedom, while at the same time, it's going to he's going to usher in a new administration of great change. And what I predict is the change will be largely cosmetic, largely one of appearance. That is, Barack Obama is indisputably a much more articulate, more quick-witted, more curious man than the person he replaces, George W. Bush. And I think that much of the reason that the American public has voted for Barack Obama is because of the dismal failure of the Bush administration. Normally, the American public, especially in times of turmoil, is not willing to vote for candidates who represent positions as liberal or as leftist as Barack Obama. But the Bush administration has been such a failure, both internationally and domestically, that the American people were willing to, and eager, in fact, to vote for a candidate who promised over and over change, change we can believe in. Change was the big message of his campaign. So eager is the American public for change that in the last months of the campaign, his opponent, John McCain, also kept on promising about how much he was going to change everything. Well, the American public wants change because there's a deep, deep dissatisfaction about the direction of the country. But I think I'm going to make some predictions here based on, and I'm trying to give reasons for it, why the change that the American public expects cannot and will not take place. The biggest reason is that the problems we have are so deeply entrenched and are so much part of a trend that's been going on for a long time that without a revolution or shock therapy or something, there cannot be any real change that's going to reverse the general direction of the country. More immediately, there's just not money to do the things that Barack Obama has been pledging. In his inauguration speech today, he was going on about how America is going to resume or once again take its position as a great leader in the world. Well, America doesn't have the same resources to do that as it once did. And that's apart from the failures and the problems of the Bush administration. Again, the problems that we're facing as a country, not only internally, but also our place in the world, are not due to the mismanagement of any one administration, not due to George W. Bush or Bill Clinton or whatever. They're really built into things that are going on in the world and in America that are far beyond the control of any one administration or any one presidency.
I don't believe Barack Obama could have been electable without the two previous disastrous presidential terms. Bill Clinton eroded the presidency from a moral perspective, and George Bush lowered the bar of the presidency with his inept handling of the war in Iraq, war against terror, and last but not least, the financial meltdown and crisis we are dealing with at this moment.
Well, I understand your point, and I think there's something to that. I'd like to talk about just two general areas in which I think we have to look at the new presidency. First of all, with regard to domestic policy and then international policy. Probably a country can, over a period of time, have interest rates or economic performance that is up or down or so forth. But whether the taxes are high or low, or whether the economy increases by 1% or goes down by 2% or increases by 8%, those things don't wreck a country. They don't change fundamentally the nature of the country. But there are some trends. There are things that do change a country in ways that are not just superficial but very profound. One of them is immigration, and the other is war on an international scale. Now, on the on a domestic level, the country is changing and has been changing. Over the last, California is now the largest, not only is the largest state in the United States, it's now majority non-white. And a number of states in the United States are already tipped over from being majority white to majority non-white states. And that's a trend that's taking place in the country as a whole. This is, this trend is fortified by the large-scale immigration from especially non-white countries, especially from Mexico, which are transforming the United States more radically, a greater, more radical transformation than took place in Eastern Europe when it was under Soviet rule for 40, 50 years after World War II. Now, we are told and have been told over and over and over by our presidents and by our educators and by our cultural, by our motion pictures and so forth over the last 20, 30, 40 years that all this is good. All this is to the greater benefit of the country. We're told over and over that diversity is a strength. Well, historically, that's not true. Historically, diversity is not a strength. Historically, in countries around the world, diversity is a weakness, not a strength. And we've seen over the last 40, 50 years in the world the breakup of diverse countries precisely because they are diverse. Now, we're told over and over that the large-scale immigration that's taking place from the third world is a good thing because it shows, quote, the promise of America. But that's really self-satisfying rhetoric. The reality is that the large-scale immigration that's taking place and the demographic trends that are taking place in America are making large parts of the country unlivable for most people. It's making large parts of the United States more and more like the very countries that the people who have immigrated have tried to get away from. Americans, in theory, say they believe diversity is a strength. They believe that immigration is a great thing for America, in theory, but they don't want this immigration to take place in their own neighborhoods or in their own cities. They like it in theory, but not in practice. And the Barack Obama presidency is not going to change that. Historically, the central fact, the central factor in American history is that this country was founded by people from Europe. If it had been founded by people from another continent or another area, it'd have a very different character than it has had for most of its history. But the founding fathers, the U.S. Constitution, the traditions we have of law and so forth are all traditions that were brought to this country from Europe. If America had been settled by people from China or Nigeria or some other country, it'd be a very, very different country. And the transformation that's taking place now, symbolized by the presidency of Barack Obama, is one that is going to make this country not more agreeable, but less agreeable to the vast majority of our population, because it's becoming more and more dramatically a third world country, with everything that that means. That means higher rates of crime, disorder, and a lack of cohesion. And that's internally what's, I think, what's happening and which the Barack Obama presidency symbolizes. Now, these trends are not caused by Barack Obama. They've been going on for a long time. And indeed, it's remarkable the extent to which both George W. Bush and John McCain were so warm in their embracing and support for the new Barack Obama presidency, as if to say that he deserves support precisely because he is symbolic of the very changes that these other men and these even Republican leaders have said they approve of. Internationally, something else is very remarkable. Even though Barack Obama is promising change, the appointments that he's made to very high levels of his administration indicates that the new administration is not going to be one of change, but one of continuity, one that will continue the rough outlines, the general outlines of policy, both under the Clinton administration and the Bush administration. Now, his supporters and the world are expecting a real change of direction in our foreign policy. But Barack Obama has said and has shown by his appointments that he agrees with the premises of this so-called war on terrorism. Barack Obama has pledged to increase the number of American troops in Afghanistan, for example. And to me, this is a dangerous thing, and it shows that far from change, that Barack Obama accepts the premises of America's role in the world and its role in the Middle East that we've had over the last 50, 60 years.
What I find interesting is that Barack Obama campaigned as an anti-Zionist in many respects. Jesse Jackson was even quoted as saying that an Obama presidency would be the first presidency in a long time that was not pro-Zionist. So you could say that his election was also a repudiation of the U.S.'s pro-Zionist stance. But the first thing Obama does when elected is recruit a radical Zionist by the name of Rahm Emanuel. So now we know it's business as usual, and business is good.
Right. Well, I was going to get more specifically into that. Barack Obama, in his speech to the AIPAC, the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee, during the past summer, and throughout the campaign, over and over again, reiterated and repeated his ardent, strong support for Israel and its policies. And more notably, the appointments he's made to high-level positions in the new administration show that he means this, that he's going to continue America's amazing policy of supporting basically whatever Israel does. This is very dangerous, and the world wants an end to this. Of course, millions of people around the world are furious and are understandably outraged at what this has meant for America's support for Israel has meant in practice. But Barack Obama's appointment of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, a woman who supported Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 2006, who supported and has supported all the other wars that Israel has engaged in, and also supported the Iraq War, sends a very different signal to the world than the one that Barack Obama gave during his campaign. Of course, his chief of staff is Rahm Emanuel, who is an ardent Zionist who is has served with the Israeli military, and whose father is an ardent Zionist. But it's not so important just the appointment of any one person. The overall thrust of his administration is to reiterate that support, which is the main reason why the United States has these tremendous problems in the Third World and in the Middle East. And that's a very, very ominous thing.
Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam supported Barack Obama, even calling him the Messiah. But one could never accuse the Nation of Islam of being pro-Zionist. I wonder how this will affect Barack Obama's relationship with his black Muslim constituency.
I think that both Louis Farrakhan and millions of Americans, black and white, are simply have great hopes and expectations that Barack Obama will be a better president. This vague promise of change allows everyone to have their own assumptions about what that change means. It's like the beginning of when a child is born or when a wedding takes place. People have different expectations about what that's going to mean in practice. And it turns out very differently, of course, obviously, than people often expect. And a lot of people are going to inevitably be disappointed. I predict that about a year from now, we're going to see a huge deflation of expectations, a huge level of disappointment and disillusionment as the reality of Barack Obama's policies become more and more obvious. Now, there are so many people in the mass media, so many supporters filled with hope, that I'm sure that Barack Obama will have a longer honeymoon period and will be given far more breaks by people than was Bill Clinton or George W. Bush, because millions of people, for emotional and other reasons, eagerly want Barack Obama to succeed. So he's going to be given a lot of support, and people don't want to see him fail for obvious reasons, even more so than was true under George W. Bush. But he can't possibly succeed, I don't think, in doing all the things that he promised during the campaign, and which once again he promised during the inaugural speech today. he didn't merely say today in his inaugural address that he was going to try to deal with these problems. He said they would be overcome. He said they will be met. This will take place. And that's a pretty sweeping promise, a sweeping pledge. He said, we will transform our schools and colleges and universities to meet the demands of a new age. Well, we'll see. But the fact is that America is already in debt way over its head, and that the loss of America's manufacturing base over a long period of time has already made things very, very bad and very difficult. And it's very difficult, it's very hard to see how in a country that's increasingly a third world country that we can possibly, that he can possibly live up to the sweeping pledges that he made in his inaugural speech today.
I believe the Barack Obama presidency will open the floodgates of affirmative action and government handouts, leading to a massive redistribution of wealth, culminating in the dismantling of America's middle class.
Of course, of course. When you say the dismantling of the middle class, that's one of the features of a third world country. One of the features of a third world country is there isn't a very prosperous middle class. There's a poor stratum, and then a very small rich stratum of society. That's one of the features. When I say America is becoming more and more a third world country, that's one of the inevitable features of that. And I think we're going to see that trend increase, because that's a demographic, hardwired kind of trend. America is becoming more of a country like Bolivia or Mexico, and less like a country like, well, Canada or Denmark or white European countries. It's even becoming less a country like Japan. American cities are less attractive. They're more run down. They're more shoddy. And all of this is a trend that has been in place and been going on for much longer than just the George Bush administration.
Judging by the failure of black leadership in this country for the last 50 years and the mess they've made of America's major cities, how could one be optimistic with regards to our first black president?
Well, I mean, Barack Obama may be very capable, and there are capable blacks, and there are incapable and incompetent whites. George W. Bush is white, but he's been incompetent and a failure as a president. To me, I think the parallel is better with South Africa. Nelson Mandela is an intelligent man, and when he took over and became the first black president in South Africa, things don't immediately unravel. He's not terribly incompetent. In fact, he's by as far as America as leaders around the world go, I think he's at least as competent as George W. Bush. But a country's character and a country's prosperity is not based just on the leadership at the top. It's based on the intelligence level and the character of the people across the board. A country can have very intelligent leadership, but however intelligent it is, if the average intelligence level, if the average level of cultural level is low, then the country is not going to do well, really, no matter who the leadership is. I don't want to disparage Barack Obama in that way, because I think he gives every indication of being at least as competent as many other white presidents that we've had in the past. But his challenges are not going to be due just to who, how he does is not going to be based just on his own abilities, or that is his administration. He has to govern the United States of America. He's the President of the United States of America. And that's going to, and how America does under his leadership is going to depend far more on who the American people are than on what he himself just does.
You bring up a good point with regards to the quality of the body politic today. Who are the American people? Who are they indeed? They elect Bill Clinton, who had oral sex in the White House and lied under oath, and George Bush, who supports the torture of prisoners. They both have been accused of snorting cocaine, rape, and murder. I mean, is it any wonder the American people had no problem electing a black man who admits to smoking crack and snorting cocaine, and has even been reported in an affair with another man? At least he hasn't been accused of murder, I guess. I mean, I guess it's a step up from the last two presidents. Indeed, who are the American people? What have they become to accept such morally unfit men for the highest office in the land?
Well, I wouldn't put the focus so much on George W. Bush or on Bill Clinton. Talk about moral presidents, for example. I think far more immoral was Franklin Roosevelt. Now, he's still held up as a great American president. But not only did he lie repeatedly to the American public, not only did he carry out actions which were illegal and unconstitutional, but historians will concede he didn't know what the heck he was doing when he became president. He tried a whole lot of things, but it was essentially war and the prosperity engendered by war that got America out of the Great Depression. But in terms of moral leadership or ethical leadership, Franklin Roosevelt was a terrible president. Even by, his own defenders will acknowledge his lies and his breaking of law, but they say, well, it had to be done, they say, for this reason or that reason. And so I don't think Bill Clinton is anything unusual in that regard. I mean, when Franklin Roosevelt died, his mistress was with him when he died, and that was covered up for a long time. He had lied to his own wife about his role with Lucy Mercer, but that's a personal thing, and it's less important, really, than the illegality and the deceit that he carried out as president of the United States in public policy. That's really more dangerous. Bill Clinton, by the standards even of most conservatives, so-called conservatives in America, Bill Clinton was a better president than George W. Bush. If you go by what the tax rate is or how the economy did or fiscal responsibility, both Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush were much worse presidents than Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton actually succeeded in removing a federal deficit in spending at least one year of his administration. George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan have the notorious distinction of running up larger debts than any other presidents in American history during their administrations. In fact, they betrayed the very principles they claim to uphold. So, I mean, these trends are not just new ones. They've been in place for a long time. But I'll put it another way. Even an incompetent president, when America was what it used to be, isn't going to wreck things too much because the country will still survive that. But to put it another way, even a very competent president is not going to be able to steer America in the right way because the country is different, the population is different, the mores and the attitudes are different, and they're not good.
I would say that most people who voted for Barack Obama were more familiar with the presidency of George W. Bush than FDR. In fact, Obama got a large share of young American voters who probably never even heard of FDR. That's why I say the failed presidency of George Bush led to the election of Barack Obama, something that wouldn't have been possible without the massive incompetence of the Bush administration, which I believe will go down in history as the worst American presidency of all time. What a legacy.
Well, it's hard to make a sweepstakes out of it, but I would point out this. First of all, I mean, George W. Bush didn't merely screw up in international affairs by launching a war based on deceit and lies, a war that was ineptly handled and was a big mistake right from the get-go. Not only did he do this, a war, the most expensive war we've had since World War II, not only did he screw that up, on the basis, by the way, of actions which were deceitful, lying, illegal, whatever you want to say, that was in international affairs, leading to America now being more despised, more distrusted than it probably ever has in its whole history. That's in international affairs, his legacy. In national affairs, he leaves office, presiding over the biggest fiasco financially and economically, again, since the Great Depression, or at least within the living memory of most Americans. Now, when Herbert Hoover became president of the United States in March 1929, the beginning of the stock market crash came in October of that same year. And people felt, well, okay, in the next election of 1932, they replaced him with Franklin Roosevelt. But nobody thought that Herbert Hoover was a dunce or a moron, a nitwit, a fool, in the way that people now look at George W. Bush, a man so uncurious, so seemingly unable even to be reflective about his own administration. So he leaves office with most of the world just saying good riddance. They hope they never even see the guy again. But again, it's not merely that a president can be incompetent. We've probably had other presidents who might have been not as competent or as incompetent, but their actions didn't matter very much, because it wasn't until World War II and the Franklin Roosevelt administration that the federal government began playing a large role in the lives of the American public or the world. When up until World War II, up until the Roosevelt administration, the federal government played a very small role in the lives of most Americans. It wasn't until after World War I that there was an income tax, for example. Around World War I, there was an income tax. Social Security didn't exist until the 1930s. The federal government, we didn't have a peacetime draft until 1940. And so in the lives of most people, the federal government just didn't play a big role. And you could have a very incompetent president, as some of them had been, but the effects were not very so terrible, because the country cranked along on a kind of local basis in a way that's not true today.
We'll be right back after a brief intermission. Don't go away, because there is more on Shank Talk Worldwide with your host Peter Shank on the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Return to Shank Talk Worldwide with Peter Shank, fighting the war of perception 5 days a week. Only on the Voice of Reason. Dare to know.
The Republicans lost the election because they failed to motivate red state America, which is primarily white and the natural base of the Republican Party. However, it appears that the lesson learned from this crushing defeat is to further alienate the white base and appeal to the non-whites, especially the Hispanics, by fielding more young, hip Hispanic candidates for public office, to coin a neocon phrase. It seems now that both parties are officially urbanized, it's okay to vote along racial lines as long as you're not white.
Well, Well, the political life of a country is going to be limited by the cultural life of a country. What I mean by that is that if the public listens and sees motion pictures and television shows and books year after year after year telling us that race is unimportant, in fact, it's wrong to even think in racial terms, then it becomes impossible for political leaders to appeal for votes on the basis of racial loyalties or racial considerations. We Americans have been subjected to a huge campaign over the past 60 years stressing that we should be ashamed of America's white history, and that white people and have on balance been a bad influence in the world, except when they supported non-whites. Young kids today grow up in school with a huge dose of propaganda telling them that Martin Luther King is the greatest American of the 20th century. The only American of the 20th century that has a national holiday named after him is Martin Luther King. We're told that Martin Luther King and what he represented is what all Americans ought to be aiming for. Now, in a society where that message is repeated over and over again, not just merely by political leaders, but in our schools, in our motion pictures, it's impossible, just about impossible then, for a political leadership in the Republican Party or any other party to then say, well, people have to think of themselves as white, when they over and over think of themselves as it, and not in any racial, cultural, ethnic, or religious terms. Culture is very important. The whoever controls the cultural life of a society and the mass media of a society sets the agenda in a broad way politically as well. And we cannot have a political party, Republican or anything else, carrying out policies or fielding candidates that are going to act contrary to the cultural messages that the American public has been given and which they accept.
This is a quote from Carter G. Woodson, father of Afro-American history. The quote goes as follows. If a race has no history, if it has no worthwhile tradition, it becomes a negligible factor in the thought of the world, and it stands in danger of being exterminated.
Well, that's a forceful or maybe overstated way to put it. But yeah, I mean, any people, any group that doesn't have a very strong sense of its own identity will die out. That's happened over and over in history, and it's happening here in our country. But the American public, this is difficult because there's always been, from the very beginning of America, a kind of conflicting message that Americans have been given, and a conflicting view of that we have of ourselves. On the one hand, Americans have been told that the most important thing is individual freedom, that the society is a good society if it ensures individual freedom and prosperity. Americans are encouraged and have been encouraged from the very beginning to think of themselves in individual terms. On the other hand, the racial or cultural or religious character of America is something, therefore, we sort of took for granted. Americans were not explicit about that. They didn't carry out policies explicitly based on race. There's no mention of race in the U.S. Constitution. But the founding fathers would have been appalled, would have been horrified to think that that this is the country that they had helped give birth to has become. It's a very different society. But look, this problem is built in many ways into the American history. Americans, whether they call themselves conservatives or liberals, accept mass democracy. They accept that the leadership should be chosen by mass elections of the whole public, including, of the entire population. That's not what the Founding Fathers believed. The Founding Fathers basically wanted America to be ruled by an aristocracy of men like themselves. They did not believe in mass voting. They certainly didn't. They believe, and at that time, the only people who could vote were white male property owners who were also Christian. And the franchise, the voting rights were restricted to a very small number. People did not vote for president originally. They were, and the Constitution does not provide that the public is supposed to vote for the president. It's supposed to, what's supposed to happen is each state is supposed to select electors who are then supposed to get together and then choose a president on their own. The public is not supposed to be involved in that process. That's how the Founding Fathers and the Constitution envisioned this. But we've moved far, far away from that. And based upon this notion, which has been in a place for a long time, that that individualism is very important. And that's why we're seeing more and more the triumph of this. And today in the inaugural speech, Barack Obama again talked about fulfilling this promise of freedom. Even conservatives accept this basic notion that the whole trend of American history is to become more and more egalitarian, to include more and more people in the idea of who's an American. And even conservatives accept that notion. So what liberals or what Barack Obama support is basically just one step ahead of what conservatives say they believe.
And yet, white conservatives are now embracing the notion of fielding Hispanic candidates and possibly electing a black man as chairman of the RNC, which will ultimately marginalize their impact on the Republican Party. They accept and encourage the urbanization of the GOP.
Well, it's hard to know what you mean by white conservatives, because it was all throughout, for the last 60 years anyway, whites did not explicitly say that they were supporting people because they were white. In other words, as I said earlier, even so-called conservatives took race for granted. No, it hasn't. Republican Party, nowhere in the Republican Party has there been any explicit appeal on the basis of race for 100 years, or more than 100 years.
What about Pat Buchanan?
Maybe he came the closest, but the person he chose for vice president was a black woman.
Ah, well done. You are correct.
I mean, far from being explicit about appealing to race, Pat Buchanan made it as pointed, as direct as he could, that he was rejecting that notion. No, I mean, the Republican Party, as I say, so-called conservatives, accept the basic premises of America that liberals also believe in. When I was a teenager, I couldn't understand what conservatives really wanted. They said the kind of America they wanted ultimately was the same kind of America that liberals say they wanted. They were just slower in getting there. And I thought, well, if those goals are really worthy goals, if we want really an America in which race, religion, ethnicity, culture is meaningless, well, we should really work to try to make that happen as quickly as possible if it's such a worthy goal. But conservatives don't say that. Instead, they always fight this sort of rearguard action, never being explicit about their principles or what's really important.
The concern with many white voters is that Obama will do to the federal government what black leaders across the U.S. have done to America's cities. There does seem to be a trend of failure when traditionally white cities become Africanized.
I understand that that concern exists, but it's not articulated. It doesn't have any leadership. It's not expressed in periodicals or in political leaders who will champion that. And that concern runs exactly counter to the message that we're told in our motion pictures by our educators and so forth. Yeah, millions of white men don't like the direction the country is going in. Polls show something like 80% of Americans are very worried about that. But that tragedy, that disconnect, is across the board. Polls show that the American public overwhelmingly wants to get a grip on illegal immigration. That's shown not only in public opinion polls, but in California, in state referenda they've had, in which the public overwhelmingly voted to deny state money to illegal aliens. But what happened? Well, the leadership of both the Republican and the Democratic Party, together with the courts and the major newspapers, simply nullified and canceled the policy expressed in vote by the people of California. And because voting for that runs counter to the whole cultural policy that Americans say they believe in. Look, and I would say more than that, though. Neither Barack Obama nor George W. Bush are really serious about enforcing our immigration laws. They've showed that over and over. In fact, George W. Bush, in one of the last interviews he gave before leaving office, stressed his regret, emphasized that he regretted that a comprehensive immigration law had not been passed that would have effectively legalized millions of illegal aliens in our country. When a nation is like that, it's not really a serious nation anymore. A country that won't define its borders, that won't enforce its own immigration laws in a rigorous and serious and comprehensive way, is not really a serious country. It's just a kind of political construct that's set up just to for the benefit of the people who are behind the political construct. It's a country that has no ethnic, racial, cultural, or religious definition. And conservatives say they agree essentially with that. Even so-called conservatives voting for a Ronald Reagan or a George W. Bush, so-called conservatives, are voting for men whose ideology and outlook is not different, is not substantially different than that of Barack Obama.
I'd like to read the quote from Carter G. Woodson one more time. This time, I want to read the whole quote, and it goes as follows. If a race has no history, if it has no worthwhile tradition, it becomes a negligible factor in the thought of the world, and it stands in danger of being exterminated. The American Indian left no continuous record. He did not appreciate the value of tradition, and where is he today? The Hebrew keenly appreciated the value of tradition as it attested by the Bible itself. In spite of worldwide persecution, therefore, he is still a great factor in civilization. That's from Carter G. Woodson, father of Afro-American history.
There's no question. I agree. I mean, no people has a more profound and lengthy sense of its own peoplehood, its own distinct identity as a group or as a community, as do Jews. And it's a sense of community, a sense of peoplehood that's fortified by the religion. That's not true of most white Americans. Americans are Christian, and the religion they believe in is a universal religion. It's one to everyone, regardless of their race or background. So that champion and further a specific racial outlook is contrary to the religious views or the religious outlook of most white Americans, because their religious leaders tell them that we should be more accepting of a person who is a fellow Christian, regardless of his race, than we should of a person who might be white but who's not a believer. Whereas Jews have a sense of community that's anchored in their own religious tradition. Very, very powerful combination.
Non-whites in this country have no problem organizing under racial lines and voting for candidates strictly on race. Just look at the results of the Obama victory. Almost 100% of blacks voted for Barack Obama. Why do you think whites fail to organize racially?
I think there are two big reasons. I think there are two big reasons, but they're rooted in America's history as a country. People came to this country from overseas to benefit themselves primarily as individuals or as families, not as members of any racial or ethnic group. And this emphasis on what's good for the individual has been a feature of American society for most of its history. That's one big reason. Another is, I think, that the religious outlook of most Americans is Christian, and that this Christian outlook is goes back further than even our identity as a country. Before America was the United States of America, it had a strong Christian tradition. And the Christian tradition, ultimately, the Christian outlook is a universal one. Now, that's different in other countries. The Danes or the Swedes or Germans or so forth, they were Danish or Swedish, to just take two examples, before they were Christian. So that their identity as being Swedish or Danish is a more primary identification a more primary consciousness than it is of being Christian. Whereas Americans, we don't have that same sense. The relationship between the religion and ethnicity or race is a different one than it is in other countries. And that's true of most peoples. Before they were became whatever religion, they had a sense of themselves as a people before that.
America was founded by white Christian men, and yet today we have come to a place in history where most American whites feel a sort of ambiguity with regard to racial differences and even guilt with regard to the role of their ancestors in creating this country.
Well, remember, the U.S. Constitution was not even explicit about race. There was ambiguity about that issue right from the very beginning. It was unclear right from the beginning, well, what should be done about blacks? What should the relationship between whites and Indians be? That was always an ambiguous thing in American life. And that ambiguity has been taken advantage of by those people who want to break down completely America's racial, religious heritage.
It appears that affirmative action policies have brought us to the brink of financial collapse, which has spread worldwide through the mortgage industry and the bad loans that were purchased abroad. Paper commodities that were based on loans that could never be paid back by the borrower, all part of a government scheme to urbanize white suburbia. This is an example, in my opinion, of affirmative action at its finest.
Well, to me, affirmative action is a symptom of something that was already in place beforehand. Affirmative action policies were introduced during the 1960s. The phrase affirmative action first appeared in an executive order, I think, by President Nixon. But the idea of affirmative action was already implicit already, even in the Roosevelt administration and certainly in the Lyndon Johnson administration. But that's already inevitable, you might say, given the outlook and the ideology proclaimed by Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson. I mean, both Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson stated over and over explicitly that we are in favor of a universal egalitarian world. Both presidents emphasized that. Woodrow Wilson emphasized that. Look, even the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence says all men are created equal. Now, when Jefferson wrote that famous phrase, he didn't really mean it exactly. That's not exactly what he meant. But he didn't write that. He thought that sounds good. It's a kind of a wish put in the form of, and then made into policy. But this idea that we're all equal, that everybody's equal, and that we should push for equality, not merely in opportunity, but also in results, in social results, that's been in place for quite a while in America. It was the Franklin Roosevelt administration that first started the first measures to demand equality in hiring on the basis of individualism and not on the basis of race in federal contracts during the World War II. And it was the Johnson administration which made that more explicit in its policies and passed the famous Civil Rights Law of 1964. And again, later, of course, the Civil Rights Law of 1968, which forbid Americans even to sell their own property with taking race into account. That became illegal in America, whereas it was widely accepted before that. So that affirmative action is a kind of logical next step, because affirmative action just says, the thinking behind affirmative action is that we should not only have equality of opportunity, we should have equality of results. And if people are really all equal, then it should be expressed an equal outcome. That is, the percentage of brain surgeons and agricultural laborers and airline pilots ought to be reflecting more or less the percentage of the population across the board, both in gender and in race.
Affirmative action policies have been used to displace white American workers, and yet many whites enthusiastically support affirmative action because they feel it makes our society more equal and fair. Somehow they just don't see the disconnect in their twisted logic.
To put it bluntly, the whole idea of an equal society is impossible. You can have equality before the law, but historically there never has been And there never will be a really equal society. The natural order of human society is hierarchical, not egalitarian. All mammalian societies, all groups of wolves, horses, and human beings throughout all of human history have been hierarchical in nature. And the question is then, on what basis, I mean, political questions, but basically the question is, how do we make this hierarchy the most effective and the most productive one that we can do? Because there will be a hierarchy. Some people are going to be on top, and some people are going to have more power, some people are going to have less power. Because in life, some people are more intelligent, some people are less intelligent. Some people are more ambitious, some people are less ambitious. That's inevitable. That's part of human nature. And it's part of all, it's part of life. But the question isn't whether there should be, the question isn't, will there be an egalitarian society? There never has been. There never will be. It's just a question of how to organize society taking that into account. There will always be a certain tension between youth and older people, for example. But a healthy society arranges things to try to make that an organic and productive thing. But aiming for egalitarianism, which is the Barack Obama presidency is proclaiming now even more forcefully, or at least more symbolically forcefully than previous administrations, its pledge for an equal America. But this isn't a new message. This message of equal society, of equal citizens, not merely in terms of opportunity, but also in terms of result, is one that American presidents have been proclaiming for quite a few years.
I don't know if you go to the movies very often, Mark, but there was a movie called Idiocracy, which was made by the same guy who created Beavis and Butthead. It was a movie about America's future. In that movie, we had a black World Wrestling Federation wrestler as president. People spoke in a strange language that was a mishmash of Mexican slang, Ebonics, with plenty of profanity for effect. They ate some sort of cheese whiz goop for their main sustenance and used a Gatorade-style drink for all of their hydration needs, including irrigation of farmland. Needless to say, this caused all farmland to become barren from the salt in the electrolyte-laden fluid. Now, considering the fact that we are the most illiterate country in the West, on par with the majority of third world countries, this type of idiocracy doesn't seem too far removed from reality. What do you say?
Well, that's an exaggeration, because you're never going to have things go quite that low. Look, the way to see the future is to take a look at societies that are further along in the same path. America is going to resemble more and more as time goes on. It's going to resemble more Mexico or Brazil or Puerto Rico, and it's going to resemble less and less Canada or Denmark or Japan. One of the biggest trends is that the overall IQ level of the American population is falling. The cultural level is falling. Anyone who's over the age of 50 or 60 and remembers America before the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s knows that in our public life, people's behavior and language was more civil. It wasn't as crude as it is. That's just a general trend in America. But it's never going to reach the level where everybody's eating Cheese Whiz, because it doesn't work very well, and there's always going to be an elite of some kind that's not going to be like that. But the overall trend is like that. That's the general drift of American life. And again, whether Barack Obama is smarter, I think Barack Obama is at least as cultured a man as George W. Bush. Certainly he speaks more intelligently and more articulately than George W. Bush. But again, the leader of a country is only isn't going to make a country change its essential character. It's sort of like a clay. You work with what you have, and the America is different today than it was 60, 70 years ago.
Mark, can you give us some idea of what to expect from the future Obama presidency?
It's hard to say what's going to happen. I mean, one thing I've been paying close attention to is that in all of the articles and discussion on television and so forth about the economy, everybody's worried about the economy for obvious reasons, but there has been not a great deal of talk about what the social consequences of all this will be. Now, what I'm trying to say is that when the economy, if the economy goes bad, if welfare checks aren't able to be paid, if there's real economic dislocation, it will also be reflected in social dislocation. That is riots, and that is breakdown of civil society. We saw a taste of that in the aftermath of the Katrina hurricane in New Orleans, when society just sort of fell apart and the police joined in the looting. We didn't see any of that. We didn't see police join in looting during even the Great Depression, when the economy was in a terrible way. But I think we can predict that if the economy continues to go down, go south here, we're going to see even social dislocation. Now, out of that, I think, will come increasingly a realization that the direction we've been going in for a long time has been a mistaken one. But what's going to happen, what has to happen if there's going to be a real turnaround, is the rising of new leadership. And that means people who don't care if they're called anti-Semitic or haters or bigoted or whatever. They don't worry about that. But right now, the majority of people who could be leaders are quiet and they're afraid. They're intimidated. And it's very hard to take a stand that's contrary to the message and the values that are propagated in our motion pictures and in our schools. It's hard to stand up and say, look, I think Martin Luther King was not a role model, when your teachers and motion pictures and political leaders all tell you something different.
Now, this is precisely why parents should get involved with their children's education and homeschool if possible.
It's very difficult, though, for a parent to fight against a whole Niagara of messages coming in television, motion pictures, and in the public schools. That's very difficult, and it's a big challenge. And I think everyone who does it is a kind of, it's courageous, even heroic, to do that. But we are, over and over, our political leaders, and I try to stress this over and over, we're being lied to on so many levels by our political leaders, in a broad way and in narrow ways. We see this corruption, this distortion of our cultural life and our political life across the board. And it's very important to first of all, let people know, stress just how grotesque the distortion really is.
Thanks for listening to Shank Talk Worldwide. You are listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Dare to know.